ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। Srimad Bhagavatam, third canto, chapter 20, text 23. This is a conversation between Maitreya and Vidura. Devo Devanjaganata, Srijati Smati Lolupan, Te enam lalupataya, maitunaya bipedare, devo devan jagadnata, shri jati smati lalupan, te enam lalupataya, Maitunaya bipedare. Deva, Lord Brahma. Adevan, demons. Jagannatha, from his buttocks. Srijatisma, gave birth. Atilolupan, excessively fond of sex. Te, they. Enam, Lord Brahma. Lolupataya, with lust. Maitunaya, for copulation. Abhipedare, approached. Translation purport by Srila Prabhupada. Lord Brahma then gave birth to the demons from his buttocks. And they were very fond of sex. Because they were too lustful, they approached him for copulation. Report. Sex life is the background of material existence. Here also it is repeated that demons are very fond of sex life. The more one is free from the desires for sex, the more he is promoted to the level of the demigods. The more one is inclined to enjoy sex, the more he is degraded to the level of demoniac life. Om agana timirandasya, jnananjana shalakaya, chakshun militam yena, tasmai shri gurave nama. Jai shri krishna chaitanya, prabhu nitananda, shri advaita gadadha, shri vasadi gaur bhaktavrinda, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Well, this is one of those verses that everyone wishes upon sannyasis. Maharaj, are you going to get into it? Or, let's hear what he's going to say. Well, I'll try to please everyone and not to offend anyone. But it's hard to be wishy-washy with Prabhupada's purports. That's the whole problem with Prabhupada's books, you see. And what can you do with a purport like this? Sex life is the background of material existence. Here it is also repeated that demons are very fond of sex life. Obviously, we can see clearly what the standard of so-called civilization is today, in which people are encouraged to, in any way possible, as soon as possible and as old as possible, simply engage in sex life. However your senses can be lustfully stimulated, you're encouraged to do that. I don't know if you are aware, but statistics from American universities reveal that at least 40% of the students have tried bisexual affairs. Not because they're homosexual, but because they've heard that, hey, you can get off in different ways. You know, you can There's more than one way to stimulate yourself. In other words, the people are so lusty, they're just willing to try anything to crave, to obtain some satisfaction. In this way, as we know, society becomes a more and more unfit place for an intelligent person to live in. Now, how are we practically going to cope with this situation in Krishna consciousness? Because the present atmosphere is so inundated with lusty desires, it makes it even more especially necessary that those who want to practice Krishna consciousness support each other and take care of each other. Because the atmosphere is so surcharged with sinful activity, it's very difficult for someone who wants to practice Krishna consciousness to survive on his own or her own. There always are exceptions, but indeed the exceptions prove the rule. That in order to practice Krishna consciousness in this day and age, a huge support system is required. A huge network of devotees is required to buttress you, to nourish you. A system and culture is required to support you in your progressive march back to Godhead. And Srila Prabhupada was transcendentally intelligent to understand this. He understood what people today need in order to go back to Godhead. That is Prabhupada's main purpose. His main purpose is not to please the academics. His main purpose is not to please the political leaders or the scientists. His main purpose is to give his disciples and future followers the ways and means, the culture, the support system, how to go back to Godhead at the end of life. So when you try to see Prabhupada in that way, everything becomes clear. He was a very goal-conscious person, a very mission-conscious person. And to achieve that mission and goal, he was so giving, constantly giving everything required for a serious devotee to go back to Godhead. Now, I remember being here in New Dwarka many decades ago during Prabhupada's appearance, and I heard the same things back then that I hear now. I remember standing on Watsika Avenue, and I believe it was the head of the Sanskrit department at that time. I was in the English department with my office right above the BBT book storage garage there across the street, and I used to supervise the production. By that time, I was supervising the production for BBT. And so I remember the head of the Sanskrit department standing on Watsika Avenue, this is about 1976, telling me, you know, his decision that he was going to leave his service and venture out into the material world and get a job. Nothing wrong with householders seeking to support themselves. But he had this whole vision that he was going to influence society by getting into it and by merging into it. And then by getting up to his neck and over his neck in, you know, material affairs, people would see that he was a devotee and become attracted to Krishna consciousness. So I remember he gave me the example. You know, it sounded to him very witty at the time. Don't you know the Krishna book? How did Krishna kill the Keshi demon? Krishna stuck his fist into the mouth of the Keshi demon, and then he expanded his fist from within the Keshi demon, and then the demon suffocated and died. Similarly, we should go deep within society and then expand and then suffocate the materialistic society and the devotees come out shining. Now, I mean, I was a young devotee, but it did sound a bit suspect to me. So I asked him, I said, well, Prabhu, are you sure that once your fist is inside the Keshi demon, is your fist going to expand or is it going to be digested? And I watched over the decades. I mean, some of us have been around for a while in Krishna consciousness, you know. We've been here, done that, seen this, seen that, heard this, heard that. So I've heard this gospel quite often. And we've seen the results that without the support system of devotees, without the loving care of senior Vaishnavas to advise you, you get massacred. We're not saying that no one should earn a living. God forbid, we're not saying that. We're not saying no one should work a job. No one should have their own home. We never say that. But what we do say is that the support system of the Vaishnavas is extraordinarily necessary. Otherwise, you'll have no ability to survive. Basically, we're talking about survival. If you can survive based on the support group of the devotees, then you can start talking about affecting society. But your first job is to survive as a devotee and go back to Godhead. Now, when I'm in India, I do preaching in Mumbai, particularly amongst many Indian devotees who, they work. And they have, some of them are very rich, big businesses. They all tell me the same thing. They say, look, if we didn't have each other, if we didn't have a devotional culture that we were plugged into, forget it. We'd be finished. Now, traveling in the West, I often hear from devotees, well, just look at such and such devotees in India. They have businesses, they have big positions, but, you know, they're Krishna conscious. Yes, that's true, but we also have to talk to those devotees themselves, and they'll tell you, if I wasn't a full contributing member of the temple, I would be finished. If I wasn't regularly doing my best to attend the temple, and regularly, when I'm not at the temple, having programs in my own home, I'd be finished. Just like if you go to the Bhaktivedanta Hospital in Mumbai. There are many, a staff of 300, most of them are devotees. They all say, if it wasn't for this hospital where devotees could work together, we would have to work solo in the material world, and we hate to think what would happen to our creeper. So this is realistic. This is realism in terms of approaching our spiritual life and how to survive in Kali Yuga. We should not become overwhelmed with fairy tale vision. I'm going to go out there and I'm going to, you know, work my job, and suddenly everyone's going to look up and I think you must be a Vaishnav. Rarely does it happen that way. And in fact, what usually happens is the opposite, that you become contaminated because the atmosphere today is so lustful. The atmosphere today is pushing on you constantly. You are the body. Think of your body. Only a fool would not be affected by this. I also remember Prabhupada saying in his last weeks in this world, he said a very interesting statement. He said, when our householders become more independent, it'll become very dangerous. He said, not that I don't mean they shouldn't work or they shouldn't have their own homes. Then he gave himself as an example. I was also a householder. I was working a business. I had my own home, children, but my whole life was temple-based. So he said, when that stops, it'll be very dangerous for our householders when they become independent of the temple culture. Now, was Prabhupada saying that just because, you know, he wanted to maintain some, you know, manpower in his institution? You know, he didn't want everybody going off because then, you know, no one would be there to staff the temples. No, Prabhupada foremost is thinking about the spiritual lives of his followers. How are they going to go back to Godhead in this lifetime when they're living in such a lustful culture in which sex life is thrown in front of their face at every moment, everywhere they look, everywhere they listen to something? A humble devotee takes this into account, that I actually have a healthy fear of material existence. It doesn't mean I'm a cultist. It just means I'm practical. Just like what's happening now with this SARS epidemic. Everybody wants to know which cities to avoid. The whole city of Toronto is very angry now because the World Health Organization has put Toronto on the list of cities that travelers should avoid. Of course, it's a huge blow to their tourist industry. It's a huge blow to their international reputation. You know, Toronto's a world-class city. But so they're protesting like anything. But the people want to know. They're pressuring, you know, the world leaders. Where are the places where SARS is? Travel agents tell me, you know, anyone who's flying overseas is always wanting to know what's the latest report from the WHO. Where should I fly into Singapore, Bangkok, or Toronto? I don't want to be anywhere near this disease. So that's how people react to material diseases. But we have an even stronger fear of getting a disease that ruins our spiritual life. And Srila Prabhupada so wonderfully sought to protect us from giving in to the desires of Kali Yuga. Now, you're in a section of the Bhagavatam, which is very interesting, the next few chapters. On the one hand, you have Brahma giving birth to demons from his buttocks. And these demons, they're very fond of sex. They're so lusty, they're starting to chase after their own father. Then you're going to hear about the sex life of Swayambhuva Manu and Kardama Muni. So what's going on here? In today's verse, you have Maitunaya for copulation. Later in this Bhagavatam, I remember, a few chapters later, you're going to see that word Maituna again. Vidura, the great sage, is going to ask Maitreya, the other great sage, tell me about the sex life of Swayambhuva Manu. This is how exciting and challenging the Bhagavatam is. What is Vidura asking? Why is he asking Maitreya about someone's sex life? These two great sages, they're on the bank of the Saraswati. And here, Vidura is asking such a question. I want to know about the sex life, the progeny of Swayambhuva Manu. He's asking because he knows Swayambhuva Manu, everything he did was devotional service, whether it's ruling the world or having a family, so I want to know about it. In the verses of that section, Prabhupada explains that we are interested in any kind of Krishna-conscious spiritual life, no matter what ashram. In fact, not only was Vidura interested in Swayambhuva Manu's sex life, but he was also interested in hearing how Swayambhuva Manu lived in opulence. Amidst all that opulence, Swayambhuva Manu maintained his strict devotional principles, and he maintained his focus on the pleasure of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. This is what we're interested in. And you'll notice, if you ever read those chapters, which I hope you will, that the word material enjoyment is discussed. It's discussed. Swayambhuva Manu lived amidst material enjoyment. Material enjoyment that is allotted by the Vedic principles. In other words, what modern society today considers an impossible life, grihastha dharma, from the Vedic point of view, that is considered a life of ample material enjoyment. So obviously, if we're going to approach the Bhagavatam, we have to do some house cleaning. We have to do some work on ourselves because we're dealing with a completely different standard. And the fact is, we're supposed to approach that standard as much as possible in the age of Kali. That means we may not be able to live with the opulence of Swayambhuva Manu, but we have to take the kernel of his life, the core of his life, which was dedication to Dharma. And the fact is, his dedication to Dharma allowed opportunity for material enjoyment. But that material enjoyment was in accordance with the Vedic principles. Our problem is, we don't think the Vedic principles allow any opportunity for cessation of our material desires, or any opportunity for gradually dealing with our material desires. That's completely untrue. It's just that our standard the standard of society today is so low that we're always looking at things with that low mentality. And in this way, we cannot advance in Krishna consciousness. I remember, some of you know, in 1975, Prabhupada speaking in Balboa Park. Maybe some of you were there. Were you there, Archita? Did you go down? Yeah, yes, he was working night and day at the BBT, but some of us, the BBT trustee allowed some of us to go down there. So there was a huge park. You've maybe even seen it on videos. Thousands of hippies were there, and Prabhupada was giving a program on a big stage, and he was starting his lecture, speaking about transcendental knowledge. And then right in the middle of the lecture, all the devotees, you know, were just astonished. One hippie boy stands up and just roars at Prabhupada, "But I want sex! And you guys can only have sex blah, blah times, and I want sex!" You know, right in the middle of Prabhupada's lecture, this huge park with thousands of people. And then we were even more astonished. Prabhupada just stopped his train of thought, stopped his lecture, and started roaring back at the guy, "You want sex? You can have it, but only once a month. You can have it." So we're all the devotees just watching this, you know, this exchange with amazement. And then Prabhupada proceeded to further blow our minds by describing in public all the details of Grihastha Dharma for procreation of children. So we're, you know, we were just brahmacharis. We're just like, oh. But this is how bold and fearless Prabhupada was in establishing the principles of human civilization so that his disciples would go back to Godhead. Our standard, the way we look at things, is so low. I mean, it's shocking if you actually try to analyze the viewpoint from which you look at things. And we drag that low-life viewpoint into Srimad Bhagavatam, and then in this way we refuse to become uplifted. We just look at it like, well, everybody knows that it's impossible to live anywhere near the standard of Swayambhuva Manu. Everyone knows this is just, these are folk tales. I mean, they're kind of inspiring, but they don't have any relation to practical life. This is our low-life imposition on the Bhagavatam, which prevents us from getting the impetus we need for going back to Godhead. If you study this group of chapters in Bhagavatam, you'll become equipped with understanding how society should work, how the brahmanas protect the kshatriyas protect the brahmanas, the wives protect the husbands protect the wives. Everybody is helping and protecting somebody. That is Veda culture. And what is the so-called culture that you have today? Everyone is exploiting everyone for the purpose of getting money and sex. That's what it's all about. Yesterday I gave a talk at the Sunday program, The Fire of Desire. And I was explaining about how people are frustrated in their loving endeavors and how they're not fulfilled in their desires to have relationships. And I explained the problem is that we are part of Krishna, and because Krishna has the loving propensity, we also have the loving propensity to a minute degree. But when we try to express that loving propensity in the material atmosphere, we're doomed to failure. So after the lecture, I was standing outside, and I was just amazed how many people came up to me and said, "You were talking to me, weren't you?" You know, these are the things that people don't immediately talk about, that they're all going through this. And here we are, often as devotees, thinking, well, you know, you got to say these things in Bhagavatam class, that material love is frustrating and that, you know, you can't be happy, you can't satisfy your senses in that way. That's the Hari Company line. But I bet out there someone's must be happy. Maybe one day I'm going to try. Yeah, I'll put in another year in the ashram and I'll check it out for myself. I mean, it's got to be somebody materially happy in California. So I was just standing outside, and one person after another just came up to me, and they practically said the same thing. "How did you know? You were talking about me, weren't you?" I mean, I've just gone through this hellish situation. So We're being equipped by the disciplined succession to deal with reality. But sometimes we are so foolish we don't recognize the great fortune that's being put right in our hands because we have this low-life mentality. In Down Under in Australia, New Zealand, they have an expression called lowrider. Do they have that here? Low in a car, low on a motorcycle. You know, some of those motorcycle guys, they have seats, Harley seats that are way down low. Whether you're sitting low in the car or low on your Harley Davidson, you're called a low rider, which means, you know, you're really a low guy, you know. So this is basically our mentality, the low rider mentality. What's this about sense control? Impossible. What's this stuff about regulative principles? Who can deal with that? Bhagavatam's interesting book, but I mean, come on, let's deal with reality where we're at. Where we're at right now, we're lusty, we're desirous of sense experience. That's what's happening. As long as we have that attitude, we're not going to make any spiritual advancement. There's just no way about it. We can't pretend. Hey, maybe we'd even like to pretend, but we've seen it for so many decades. Those of us who've been around for a while, it doesn't work. Prabhupada was telling it as it is. The Bhagavatam is telling you as it is. Now you've got to adjust your life to deal with that. Another story, some of you may know. One devotee tells it in his memoirs. That Prabhupada was chanting on the Vyasasan, Jai Radha Madhava, in Vrindavan. And he kept looking at the devotee who was fanning him. And then went on chanting. Then he would look at the devotee who was next to him fanning him. Then go on chanting. So the devotee who was fanning him he was thinking, well, maybe I'm fanning wrong, or I don't know. Prabhupada keeps looking at me periodically, and I don't know what's going on. I'll just keep fanning, and I guess I'll find out about it later. You know, maybe I'm just not moving my hand the right way and fanning or something. So then Prabhupada finished chanting Jai Radha Madhava, and he was saying the Prema Dhwani prayers. After he finished, before he started his lecture, he just looked at this devotee next to him. And then Prabhupada rolled up his sleeve. He said, you feel an itch. You scratch one time. You scratch two times. You scratch three times. Why do you stop? And Prabhupada said, not because you're satisfied, but because there's blood. That was it. That was all he said. And the devotee was like, Prabhupada knows where I'm at. That was it. Such a profound statement. Such philosophy, so deep, such deep philosophy and such a powerful example. You don't stop scratching in sex life because you're satisfied. That's the illusion. You stop because you made a mess of yourself. This is the truth that's not being told. There's no way that, okay, yeah, that was satisfying. I'll stop scratching. No, no way. When you make a mess of yourself, when you're fried, when you're disgusted with yourself, when your relationship crashes, then you stop. And of course, because you don't have any higher taste, because you have no knowledge, as soon as the feeling of misery passes, you'll be at it again. But Prabhupada's point was essentially this. You do not give up sense gratification because you've been satisfied. This is revolutionary truth. You give it up because your life is such a mess. Because you're suffering so much. Next time, I don't know if he comes here. I think he's been here before. Dr. Leeladhar Gupta, the Ayurvedic, young Ayurvedic doctor from Vrindavan, he comes. Ask him, this is what I've done before in other places, ask him to give a lecture about what the Ayurveda says about what excessive sex life does to your health. These are the things that Western medicine doesn't teach you. It's there to some degree in Chinese medicine, which is getting very popular now. And it's definitely there in Ayurveda. When you hear about how you're taking your own life, practically, in this activity of so-called enjoyment, you become very hesitant, like, whoa, what's going on here? How come no one ever told me this before? I'm ruining my own health. I mean, it's there, that message in the Bhagavatam, the camel tasting its own blood, chewing thorns, and then savoring the taste of blood in its mouth, thinking this is pleasure. The example is there in Bhagavatam. And to hear a doctor explain all the medical things that you do to yourself while pursuing lusty desires is really a sobering experience. So we have to have some determination that I'm going to deal with myself in Krishna consciousness. Then you'll feel the mercy of Lord Chaitanya. If you want to feel the mercy of Sri Sri Gornatai, you've got to make that internal decision. I'm going to arrange my life for becoming Krishna conscious. And then you'll understand. I need a whole support system of devotees I can depend on. I need trustworthy senior Vaishnavas who are proven to get advice from. Otherwise, I could be just reinventing the wheel every year, thinking, yeah, this looks good. Yeah, this looks like it's Krishna conscious. And I'll just get into trouble. I need association. I need people to talk to. I need friends. If I'm simply solo in the material world, you know, trying to change the world from the inside, I'll be extinguished in a second. So this is what a devotee who's serious about going back to Godhead starts to think about. Not that, hey, just let me get my university degree, let me get a good job, I'll be out there with the people, with the materialists, and they'll all just become affected by my radiance. You're dreaming. And in fact, talk to any honest devotee who works in the material world. They'll all tell you, it's a struggle, you know. First of all, I'm trying to save myself. And then if I see a chance, I can explain Krishna consciousness to someone, I do that. But it's not easy. And unless I take shelter of the holy name and the Vaishnavas, I'm finished. That's the talk of someone who knows what's going on. But sometimes we have these devotees who get these fairy tales in their mind. Like, oh, I'll study, I'll get a job, and presto, I'll be out there, and people will become Krishna conscious just by me being out there. It can happen in exceptional cases, and the exceptions prove the rule. There are some senior Vaishnavas who've been in Krishna consciousness through so many circumstances for so long, 30 years, 35 years, yes, they're like walking touchstones. But for a young devotee, or even a medium to old devotee who's not strong in his or her spiritual life, to think they're going to do that, they're dreaming. Everything requires a price. And the price for being Krishna conscious yourself and affecting others in Krishna consciousness is that you have to be very firmly rooted in a Vaishnava support system, a network of caring, a network of advice. In this way, your spark of bhakti won't go out while you're trying to live amidst today's super lusty atmosphere. This is the honest appraisal of life in Kali Yuga now and how to go back to Godhead. Please don't allow yourself to start dreaming that, you know, yeah, just like Krishna's hand inside the mouth of the Keshi Devan. I'll never forget that example. We'll just march out there with our degrees, with our jobs, and then expand our Krishna conscious potency, and presto, everyone around us is going to become Krishna conscious. No. What generally happens is that such devotees become dissolved and digested by the material energy very easily. We've seen this so many times. There are a few exceptions, but as I said, those exceptions prove the rule. No need to tempt Maya. If we situate ourselves within the society of devotees very firmly, whether we're living in the ashram or not, then we're getting a chance to get Prabhupada's full protection, and we can march back to Godhead in spite of today's surcharged atmosphere of lust. In spite of all that, just like Swayambhuvamanu, in spite of the opulence of Satyayuga, which is far beyond what we can understand, he maintained his Krishna consciousness. So that was his challenge, how to be Krishna conscious amidst the opulence of Satyayuga. Our challenge is how to be Krishna conscious amidst the lusty degradation of Kali Yuga. In both circumstances, it is possible without a doubt. So if we keep that in mind and make the necessary adjustments in our life and don't have any sentimental dreams, we'll be able to stay on the progressive path back to Godhead. Any questions? So, last Prabhu.
You gave wonderful points and for a very wonderful class. Just by being in the administration in Krishna consciousness through the years, I found that a lot of devotees, they always have like 1,001 excuses why they shouldn't be able to, go on in Krishna consciousness. And I find that recently in these particular days, a lot of times devotees go out because they say that Krishna consciousness doesn't produce enough challenge for them. Like, there's not enough challenge in Krishna consciousness, that they want to expand their horizons of knowledge. And they feel that a lot of times Krishna consciousness has that to offer. That they feel that they need to go out and learn more and develop more themselves personally. And I think you kind of mentioned that last night about when somebody wants to break a relationship, you made that point. You said, well, it's not you, it's me. So I find that when the boy sits in my office and one day they decide to leave, they tell me the same thing. Savas, it's not Krishna consciousness. I really believe everything is going on. I like everything, I like the chanting, the prasadam, the association, but it's me. I need to get that degree. I need to get that job because it's just challenging for me. And in Krishna consciousness, not enough of that for you. Do you want to expound that?
Yes. This mentality comes from a lack of understanding of what is bhakti yoga. A lack of taking seriously Prabhupada's books. That means trying to see material nature for what it is. The main challenge that we're trying to deal with is controlling our senses. If you accept that as a career, then your life will always be rewarding. But if you don't accept controlling your senses, mastering your senses as a career, then you'll just trip out in so many ways and you'll easily become a victim of Kali Yuga. You've got to be practical. What is your lifetime career? Whether you're working a job or not. That's not the point. We're not against people working, having homes, getting jobs. But still, you have to keep your core purpose in mind. Your core purpose, your core challenge is to control my senses and to develop a taste for Krishna's glories. Now, that's enough to fill at least one lifetime. Just like Prabhupada said about his books. He said, I've given you so many books, you don't have enough time in your one life to master them. Now think about that. Every time I read Chaitanya Charitamrita, and I've been reading it for 3 decades, and back in this 75, we were, the English department, we were reading Chaitanya Charitamrita 12 hours a day, because we had to for Prabhupada's marathon to produce the books. And now, 30 years later, I still think, I don't understand a drop of this book. It's so far, it's so deep. So this is our challenge, how to control our senses and how to get a taste for Krishna's glories. That's the core of your life. That's enough, really, to fill the main part of your existence. Then whatever else you do, whether you work outside or not or go to school or not, that is all just incidental. This is what you'll read when you study Swayambhuva Manu. His core was glorifying Krishna. His core was always remaining in thought of Krishna. That was his challenge. And with that Krishna conscious attitude, he then did all his duties. So we should not have these twisted mentalities that, hearing and chanting about Krishna, coming before the deity, it's nice. I got nothing against it, but I need something else. No, what you do need is to face what is the actual challenge of life. You have senses. What are your senses going to do? How will your senses remain pure as you progress in this life through Kali Yuga? That is the challenge. How are you going to hear the holy name? That's the main challenge of your life. That when you accept the main challenges, then you keep everything in perspective. But if you don't understand what the main challenges are, you immediately get carried away in all sorts of artificial New Agey stuff. Well, you know, I've got to find myself, you know. All of us have a particular purpose in the cosmos, and I've got to go through my learning experiences to uncover myself. And, yeah, Krishna consciousness is fine. Yeah, I like the devotees, but, you know, I just got to, you know, do something that's going to really bring me out. You understand, right? Yeah. You know, right? They all say, you know, right? And they look at you, you know, right? And you just look at them and with a blank face. And, well, you don't know, huh? Well, all the more reason why I'm going. So I think we have to have a better understanding of what challenges are, and then we will be immune from this kind of delusion. Yes?
Since the body is actually a lot of challenges, they should go to Sankirtan. Because they preach all day and they will be so satisfied. Everything is here in Sankirtan. It's the top of the front line.
Well, I can't disagree with that. We have to be aware there are different types of devotees with different levels of commitment. And yes, we'd like all the devotees to have this attitude, as you're saying, but not all of them are that strong. So what I'm discussing, what Savas is asking about, is not like the Mahatma attitude. We're just talking about the entry-level requirements. Let's put things in perspective now. We're not talking about Mahabhagwats. We're not talking about, you know, seven-day-a-week Sankirtan devotees or whatever. We're talking about just the attitudes required to keep you in the ball game, you know? That's all. The basics. If you don't address the basics of Krishna consciousness, you're going to easily be overrun by Maya. So we're just speaking about the basics here. What is the challenge that you should be addressing? Whether you're a weak devotee or a strong devotee, you have to deal with these points in good association. Yes?
Just one more question. You mentioned that also that one should stay in the fire of Krishna consciousness. Whether one is working a job or whatever, you know, you can be working out there, but one should stay in the culture or the association. Well, we find that, you know, just to say, for instance, we'll just use the work as an example. We find that some householders, and I hope I don't get ostracized for this, but we find that some householders, they may allow their partners just to venture out into the world. And kind of like this decrease their Krishna consciousness. You know, and they may gain Krishna consciousness, but they may allow their partner not to even actually do any service. They may not even preach to them to, you know, do service. So what can we do as administrators in Krishna consciousness is that to increase or encourage the devotees to get back into the fire of Krishna consciousness. Even though they may have run on the block, they may not come to the program. Mm-hmm. We don't know if they're changing their job. Mm-hmm. Maybe they're just going out and getting a job. Maybe they just don't even do any service. Mm-hmm. Maybe in a given day they may do 1 hour of service in the temple. And mm-hmm. that's it. The rest of the day they're doing so many other things.
Mm-hmm. What you'll see in these chapters about Swayambhuva Manu and his wife Shatarupa and the daughter Devahuti, and then the future son-in-law, Kardama Muni, you're going to find a whole system of mutual care and responsibility in which everybody is looking out for somebody else. And any kind of relationship means responsibility. The wife is responsible for protecting the husband. The husband's responsible for protecting the wife. They have different ways of doing that according to Vedic culture, but still the mutual responsibility is there. No one can just say, all right, you do whatever. No one can do that. The brahmanas can't do that for the kshatriyas. The kshatriyas can't do that for the brahmanas. Everybody's interlocked in a system of caring and mutual nourishment. So if we keep that in mind and make the point that whatever kind of relationship you're in, whether it's administrative or family, whatever, the person you're relating to means there's responsibility. If we go at it in that way, perhaps persons might listen a bit, that you just can't abdicate or just jettison your responsibilities to somebody else, although it's the easiest thing to do. No, you're in a relationship. You have a duty. Vedic culture is very duty conscious. We're not trying to establish everything in Vedic culture now, but the fact is we should appreciate the spirit of obligation and responsibility. That is the actual essence of relationship. So then, the husband and wife, they have their duties to each other. They have their responsibilities to care for each other in a certain way. Any kind of relationship, governmental, advisory, whatever, implies responsibility of care and exchange of nourishment. That is the spirit of the of these chapters that we can apply in our situation today. It's amazing. The Sanskrit term is called bhakti karya, reciprocation between persons of different statuses. It's very important. All right. All glories to the Prabhupada. Hare Krishna.